This program is brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. We hope you enjoy the program. Hello, and welcome to the latest mini-sode episode of the Anchoring Truths podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Snedeker. Today, Program Director Daniel Osborne and I share a little bit about our recent trip to Cambridge, Massachusetts, specifically Harvard Law School, for the annual National Student Symposium of the Federalist Society. The topic of the symposium was Why Separate Powers, and that cuts right to the core of the mission at the James Wilson Institute. We're delighted to share with you more about our visit and give you a little peek behind the curtain.
Hello and welcome to the Anchoring Truths podcast. My name is Daniel Osborne. I'm the Programs Director at the James Wilson Institute. I have the pleasure of joining Garrett Snedeker, our Deputy Director today, for another special short episode. This one, we're just going to have a brief discussion of, I suppose, some of our adventures within the world of the conservative legal movement. In particular, this past weekend, we had the distinct pleasure of visiting the National Student Symposium of the Federalist Society. Many thanks to the Federalist Society, and particularly to the Federalist Society chapter at the Harvard Law School, for hosting not only us, but was it 700 students that were there?
Is that right? It was amazing. I haven't been to too many of these, but it was easily the largest one that I've been to. And it's so well run. I think hosting this many students in the spaces that the conference held, it took a lot of coordination. And it was fun to see some of our friends from the National FedSoc office make the pilgrimage up to Harvard Law School, one of the founding chapters of the Federalist Society, just to make sure that everything ran smoothly, and indeed it did.
Our compliments certainly to the Federalist Society chapter, also to the Federalist Society staff. It was an excellent event, and again, thank you for having us along for the ride. There were several different groups that were there, such as Alliance Defending Freedom, New Civil Liberties Alliance, that were there also to talk with students. Garrett and I were primarily there to talk with them and kind of raise awareness about JWI, what we do, and particularly talk about our fellowship and talk about the law school seminars as well. But I want to focus, first of all, on kind of the meat of the discussion for the weekend. The topic, if I recall, was why separate powers? Mm-hmm. Seems like an almost maybe overwhelmingly large question, but they really brought to bear quite a solid group of speakers and panelists to really go through and discuss this question from multiple angles. Why separate powers, both between the different branches of the federal government? Why separate powers through the lens of federalism? Why separate powers just in a general principle of government? Really some very interesting discussions, and I was out in the hall for quite a bit of it, but Garrett, you were there for several of the sessions. Would you want to highlight any particular panels?
Sure. Yeah, the opening fireside chat between Judge Raymond Kethledge of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals and Professor Cass Sunstein of Harvard brought out not your usual distinctions between what Judge Kethledge, broadly a right-of-center thinker and jurist, and then Professor Sunstein, broadly center-left, if not probably a little further to the left than Judge Kethledge is to the right. I think that it was a helpful way for us to begin that conference because immediately Judge Kethledge and Professor Sunstein were drawing distinctions from some of the normal justifications for the separation of powers. For example, there's one that our listeners on our podcast, to our podcast, may remember from when we had on Professor Bill Allen and we were discussing Montesquieu. Just the term separation of powers doesn't quite capture what the founders were drawing on. It's more separation of functions or abilities, and that checks and balances is a better way to capture what we traditionally now have come to understand as separation of powers. And I think Judge Kethledge did a very good job because he was telling the audience that in his position as a judge, he's constantly thinking about those times when the three branches are isolated, and then in those moments of isolation, what the other two branches can do to countermand, the branch that is perhaps overstepping its boundaries. And so in not just falling back on the standard lines of ambition counteracting ambition, because that's really more about how actors in the scheme are to be viewed as having like personal ambitions, but that really each branch does have an independent duty to interpret the Constitution as each branch understands it. That becomes much more of a debate over what we traditionally now, in Federal Society circles, we'll hear about, standard canons of construction, standard tools for interpretation, that at the end of the day, those are more to be tested by reasonableness, and then whether or not each individual branch has the prerogative to act, but then the duty to persuade the other branch to go along with it. This is something that came out very fully in the panel featuring Professors Gary Lawson, John Harrison, Jeannie Suk Gerson, and there's one professor from Harvard, I believe it was Professor Taylor, I don't remember her first name, or Tyler, Amanda Tyler. And that came out because of the discussion that they were having over judicial supremacy. And that panel, I thought, was the most timely one of the entire symposium. But that was actually the one, Daniel, that you also attended. So maybe have some thoughts of your own on that one.
I mean, that was a fascinating discussion. Really, particularly, I was interested that they opened with kind of the perspective, first and foremost, of how we view what the role of the judge is and what the role of the courts are, I suppose what the role is, as they're making decisions. Okay, there's the perspective of, are we deciding cases on a case-by-case basis, looking at the individual facts and then applying the law to those individual facts, but doing it in a way that's cohesive and trying to be not quite systematic, but coherent mm-hmm. from case to case to case. But then the flip side of that is this discussion of what about the role of the judge as kind of the one who proclaims what the law is, mm-hmm. the one who looks at the law, interprets it, and declares it from on high, as it were. And therefore, through their force of declaration and interpretation, that being where the power and the substance of judging is. And really, particularly Professor Lawson was making the argument that it was the former rather than the latter. It was rather mm-hmm. that role as case decider, mm-hmm. case by case basis, that's the core of where judgment is. And when you understand judgment through that lens, it really begins to dismantle the, I suppose, lens or the mindset of judicial supremacy that so right. many, particularly conservatives, have kind of become entrenched with over the past, maybe the past decade or so.
Right.
And so seeing that shift brought to light and particularly focused on, I thought was very rewarding, especially to see the students interacting with those questions.
Yeah, I went up to Professor Lawson afterward, and just for the benefit of our listeners so they know, I was actually students with Professor Lawson's son at Scalia Law School, so I've had the good fortune of meeting Professor Lawson on a few other occasions, but and hearing lectures of his over the years. That presentation by Professor Lawson echoed what we've been teaching in our seminars, not only the James Wilson Fellowship, but now also more and more of our law school seminars, about the different frame by which I think students are classically taught about how the federal courts operate, and then how, some of the most prolific thinkers, but also how the founders thought that there wasn't this assumption of judicial supremacy for the federal courts to operate on, that that was a habit and a practice. Granted, it was established early on in a far less conclusive way than it is, you know, pretty much cemented in the last, 50, 60 years in how the federal courts operate, but that there are these kind of two models. And as Daniel was alluding to, there's the law declaration model, which has been equated with judicial supremacy. And then there's the rule deliberation model, meaning that each individual case will bring forth a rule that comes out of it, but that the rule is only binding insofar as it's persuasive enough on other judges to adopt that rule in their own opinions. But then also there's a wholly separate question of whether the political valence of that rule is so strong that the political branches, the executive and the legislature, choose to adopt that reasoning through their own individual branches' prerogatives. So this came through extremely clearly when Professor Lawson was discussing some of the different flashpoints when it comes to how courts operate when it comes to the decisions that necessarily need to get made by executives or things that are more like classically legislative determinations, that a judicial ruling on these more classically either legislative or executive arenas have to be viewed through the lens of not some kind of lightning bolt that then freezes the executive or freezes the legislature, but rather a case and a controversy that then is isolated, not something that just sort of flips over the table and causes the entire system to come to a grinding halt. I thought that Professor Lawson and Professor Harrison had a good spirited debate. To be fair, Professor Harrison did make some of the standard counterarguments that if we were to adopt a rule deliberation model for the federal courts, which is rejecting this long practice of judicial supremacy, you would get far less coordination and there would be lack of clarity that I think the federal courts have come to rely on. But then it begs the question in response, which is what Professor Lawson would say, of whether or not it's good to actually have coherence and clarity when there's something fundamentally wrong about the legal reasoning in the first place, or expedient. For lack of resources, federal courts sometimes make decisions and then other federal courts will like rubber stamp them without any kind of bigger picture deliberation, unless the issue is forced.
Well, and that question of the practicality of going through every case and evaluating each case individually was highlighted when the discussion turned to the courts particularly asking to have the capacity in order to turn down cases, to decide which cases to take and which that they were going to take, effectively meaning that those that they chose not to take were simply left to the example of the most recent, most similar case available, right, through standard practice of stare decisis. But in that way, that is a deferment of that position as the case decider, and which in that sense begins to almost automatically shift the role of the court over into law declarer. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the courts can only take so much. If they had to take every single case of every single kind,
they don't offer advisory opinions. We're not telling them to do that.
Oh, exactly. It would be a morass within a few years after that change. But at the same time, the practicalities can only lend us so much force when they're put up against a question of what is actually a just system.
Right.
And particularly what is the role of a judge in a just system.
Right.
Is the core of this question here. And really one of the fundamental questions of how law functions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's why it was valuable not to just have Lawson and Harrison debating. Mm-hmm. That's why Professors Tyler and Professor Gerson were quite useful, because they're broadly of the left. They were trying to translate the importance of this debate to the students that may not have been in the room.
Sure.
And these were the the law students who represent probably 80% of all law students, the left of center law students, particularly like the hyper progressive law students, who see now perhaps judicial supremacy in a new light, because they are the ones that for generations could look to the Supreme Court to vindicate their progressive policies through lawfare or just through, your traditional public interest campaigns, right?
Sure.
But that if the Supreme Court, which is, has a somewhat of a durable originalist majority, is now their kind of on the merits foe, then they look to judicial supremacy with a new light, because judicial supremacy would then foreclose how strong in opposition they could be to court decisions.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And so what Professor Tyler in particular was making an impassioned plea to, again, probably not the students who were in the audience, but the students who may have been listening to the recording, she was making an impassioned plea to them to separate their thinking on the merits of these various cases from how they think about courts should operate.
Yeah.
And that is such a valuable lesson, I think, because, you and I hear from law professors and judges all the time, and one of the things we'll often hear is, look, I want to test your approach along these lines. Name for me a policy goal that you think your approach would not redound towards, because then you've shown me that your lens has faithfulness to some kind of neutral process that isn't kind of related to having the answer worked out, and then you're working yourself backwards to reason towards an outcome you've predetermined, right? But what we would say here is that our faithfulness to fight judicial supremacy probably cuts against some of the settlement that may redound towards some of the policy goals that we would at JWI prefer.
Sure.
However, the cause of judicial fighting judicial supremacy is strong enough so that indeed it becomes one of these ways that we can demonstrate our faithfulness to how each independent actor in the constitutional scheme has a duty to uphold the Constitution according to the best understanding that this office holder in the branch has, but that becomes indeed the way that we can reason. We use that, we don't use that term lightly. We can reason through to what is the most coherent and faithful rationale in accordance with the natural law, even if that indeed bucks notions of stare decisis, even if that indeed doesn't provide the kind of settlement and finality that judicial supremacy does.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, what we're seeking in this, particularly through the lens of a judge as case decider, is really not the end of a conversation. It's not settlement, it's the start of a conversation. Between the branches. So you have the conversation between the judge and then the appeals, and that goes on, and there's a debate, and eventually there's a rational argument that is settled on it that explains the course of the case. And then that then is also pushed back on with policies and legislation from the other branches. And so there's this ongoing discussion that finally has to resolve itself, but it's resolved not when one particular actor settles the question, but it's resolved when the other branches are willing to accept the reasons that have been given to it.
That's right.
And through that reasoning, we get this synthesis between them. And that gets the question of what is settled law in that sense. Professor Arcus likes to refer to, do we mean by the concept that the debate is settled by the fact that we've been persuaded?
Yeah.
Have we been persuaded? If we haven't been persuaded, then the argument's not over yet.
That's right. That's right. And then of course it falls to the political branches to have to make prudential determinations. And
of course,
unfortunately, the Congress has not been as reliant. We've not been able to rely on the Congress to be able to act as perhaps earlier Congresses have acted.
Sure.
The classic example I give is that after the Smith decision in 1990, within 3 years, the RFRA Act was passed grounds that we would have never, expected in today's political arrangements, but nonetheless. After Smith, there were broad coalitions, and I think you can square what Professor Arcus has written about Smith with then what RFRA was as a political determination.
Absolutely.
So I thought that the conference was well timed, and even if you're on the left and you didn't attend this conference or had an interest in attending this conference, there were some notable takeaways for you. And,
absolutely.
Again, we praise our friends at the Federal Society for putting together such a great conference, because I think it was, very much touching on some of the core themes of what we do at James Wilson Institute, but also some of the more kind of pressing issues for, young lawyers, and then those in the public interest space who are trying to navigate, for example, a post-Dobbs world, because, Dobbs really, represents one of these cases where you might disagree with the policy outcomes, but you can look to that opinion and probably, have just as fruitful a discussion of, well, how do we understand it as a legal opinion?
Yes.
Completely, right? Like completely
Absolutely.
Separate discussion, which we have engaged in at JWI with notable vigor. But that gets separate, that's a separate discussion from the merits.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, we'd be remiss if we passed up a discussion of this conference without turning to what was happening outside of the panels.
Yes.
Again, 700 students, or 700 attendees at least, I should say. Not everybody fit into the hall.
That's right.
That's a very clear point
that's
I
right.
have to make. They had to set up several overflow rooms where they streamed down the video of what was happening at the panel. And people were still revolving around through the different overflow rooms, through the halls.
That's right.
There was lots of discussion that was going on. Again, like I mentioned, we were excited to see groups like Alliance Defending Freedom, New Civil Liberties Alliance that were there, Institute for Justice, I think, was there.
Pacific Legal, TFAS, yeah.
Yeah. This really was a good opportunity for groups like ours to connect with and speak with students, especially as they're getting launched towards their careers. We were, of course, excited to see several judges who were there for the panels, and really it was good to see them interacting with the students, and the students had the opportunity to interact with them. So really quite an energetic...
Very energetic.
Hallway scene.
It was wonderful
sure.
to see at least five alumni of our James Wilson Fellowship.
Absolutely.
A lot of recent alumni.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also great to meet the chapter leaders of some of the schools we hope to visit in the near future with our law school seminars. Yeah, just really a fantastic conference.
Yep.
And so with that... We're thankful to all of our listeners, and we look forward to the next time we can gather for one of these new mini-sodes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks, Sierra. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
This program has been brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. Thanks for listening.